RRR is one of the most expensive and highest grossing Indian films ever made. It's also the most watched film on Netflix that isn't presented in English. It's a sweeping and bloody, sort of historical epic about the unlikely friendship between two men who seem to be working at cross purposes. One a villager fighting against India's British colonizers, the other a soldier working with them. RRR has breathtaking stunts, stirring songs, and a story about male friendship that's made it an international phenomenon. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about RRR on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is film critic and culture journalist Badatri D. Chaudhry. Hey, Badatri, welcome back.
Hi, Glenn. Glad to be back, as always.
Well, it's great to have you, and man, there's so much to talk about in this film, so let's get into it.
Yep.
RRR stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt, or Rage, War, Blood in Telugu. It's set in India in the 1920s, when the country is still under British rule. N.T. Ramarao Jr., who also goes by NTR or NTR Jr., plays a revolutionary freedom fighter who's sent from his remote village to rescue a village girl who has been kidnapped by the British governor and his wife. The governor tasks a young Indian man who's enlisted in the British military to hunt this freedom fighter down. He's played by Ram Charan. When the two men meet, neither is who he seems to be, but they become deep and trusted friends while each is pursuing a hidden agenda. RRR is streaming on Netflix in Hindi, but it's not a Bollywood film. Rather, it's a Tollywood film produced by the South Indian industry that makes films in the Telugu language. Its leads are two of India's biggest stars who appear together on screen for the first time. Their characters are based on two historical freedom fighters, but writer-director S.S. Rajmouli takes liberties with their stories, big ones. Everything about RRR is big. In fact, its budget, its visuals, its stunts, its bloodlust, its ability to get audiences cheering its heroes and booing its villains, but perhaps the biggest thing about RRR is its heart and its portrait of friendship that can emerge out of the bloodiest conflicts. Badatri, oh, this is a big movie. Talk to me about it.
Oof, where do I start? Okay, So let me start off with some context, which is always a good place to start.
Right.
Like you said, it's not coming out of what we know as quote-unquote Bollywood. It's not a Hindi film. And so it's coming from the South Indian film industry, which is, yeah, I would say it's a rival film industry. Mm-hmm. And two of the historically favorite genres of this industry are Hindu myths, mm-hmm. where literally people play gods and goddesses, and freedom struggle stories. And RRR kind of brings both these together.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit about South Indian fandom. When I say fandom, every Friday when a film used to release, there's this superstar called Rajnikant. They would like literally pour milk over his poster, which is a Hindu practice, which they do to idols, right? So the fandom is almost cultish. And this film is huge, even beyond everything that we see on screen, because of the two actors in it. Like you said, they're appearing for the first time, but they belong to like film royalties, like absolute royalties. So NTR Jr.'s grandfather, N.T. Ramarao, was an icon. His photographs have seen a lot of milk being poured on them. And as is Ram Charan's father, Chiranjeevi, who is also a huge, huge superstar. So the coming together of these two dynasties, which doesn't happen often, they may be friends off screen, but they never appear together on screen. So this coming together of the dynasties is very important, and which is, even before people knew what the film is about, it was going to be big in India. And that is why the name is RRR, Ramarao, N.T. Ramarao, Rajamouli, and Ram Charan.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so that's a clever little wordplay there.
What'd you think of the film itself?
I enjoyed it, you know. Of course, I think everything needs context. I think it's a fantastic spectacle, which is not something you see on screen too much because, for better or for worse, our films have moved away from that. So I love that spectacle, but, you know, some bits of it made me uncomfortable, and of course, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we'll get to that especially. But I do agree with you. Spectacle's the magic word. The experience of watching this movie is just the best commercial, 3-hour commercial for the act of watching movies I can think of. It's just the moviest of movies. It is stirring. It is powerful. It gets you going, gets your heart pumping, gets your fist pumping, all of which are nice ways to say it is manipulative as hell.
Yes.
And it's so ruthlessly effective at that. Yes, it's pulpy. Yes, the bad guys are cartoons and the heroes are shining virtuous knights. But pulpy, you got to say this about pulpy, it's satisfying. This is such a satisfying movie to watch. Now, when it's over and your higher brain functions start to kick back in, you might start to feel a different way about it. I did. But in the moment, man, it sweeps you up.
It does. It does. And then, you know, it comes at a time where multiverse is the big buzzword.
Yeah.
So it's also like playing a little bit into that fandom. Mm-hmm. And the special effects are great, you know, and they're very advanced, at par with the rest of the world. And like you said, this huge budget. So yeah, I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah. And before we get to the politics, let's talk from just a craft of filmmaking perspective. I talked to a lot of folks about this film, both critics and non-critics alike, and we're all reaching for the words to describe it, just to convey to folks who might want to see it that it is a lot. So we reach for words like over the top and maximalist. I keep saying the word maximalist. Big swing, out of control. And that's the one that I shy against because nothing about this film, not a single frame of it, is out of control.
Yeah.
So the word I've settled on, and this is the hill I'm going to die on, is operatic, because, you know, opera can get big and swoony, as this film gets, and spectacular, but it can't be sloppy. You know, wouldn't work without a sense of kind of internal rigor and the sense, a formalist approach, I guess, is what I'm saying. So everybody's executing their jobs with incredible precision. There is a train wreck sequence early on. I say early on, it's probably about an hour in, where the two men rescue a small boy from a train crash. And it is hilariously big. And it just keeps getting bigger. And it goes off into campiness, as you mentioned. But it is also intricately structured. The visuals, the stunts, the acting, the editing, there's just this degree of control that is asserted to get everyone in the audience reacting exactly the same way at the same time.
Yep.
We are putty in this guy's hands.
Yeah. That's when you know it's so mobilizing, this film.
Uh-huh.
Like you said, like such chaos, but such control over that chaos.
Right.
It's almost like puppets.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get to it. The violence in this film isn't blockbuster cartoon violence. There is torture. There is blood. It's there to motivate you. It's all fueled by this sense of moral outrage, you know, of revolution.
Hmm.
There's never any doubt that their cause is righteous because their cause happens to be righteous. Now, there has been criticism of this film, including a really interesting piece in Slate by Nitish Pawa, who's struggling with the degree of nationalism that this film not only embraces, but I would say embodies.
Hmm.
And here, the target of that nationalistic rage is British colonizers. And I think any person with a passing interest in world history will look at that and go, yep, fair.
Yeah.
it's a historical gimme. But of course, this film does not arrive in a vacuum. India is experiencing a right-wing nationalistic prime minister. This film certainly feeds that mood, specifically Hindu nationalism. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, like before that, I'll just say that, you know, this film has everything, romance, little action, song and dance, and, you know, bromance bordering on homoeroticism. I'm not going to give more spoilers, but people will see for themselves. But the glue is nationalism. That is what is appealing. Seemingly, they go for the lowest hanging fruit and, oh, British. And that's always a favorite story anywhere in the world, right? So you're right. It feeds into that. But I think the problem is it takes something which is kind of secular, which is the freedom struggle, where everyone from every background, every religion participated, but gives it a very Hindu mythical veneer in the film. Of course, this person is called Ram, which is a big god. And then especially if you remember the last scene, like throughout this film, he is dressed a certain way. And then there is a complete change of costume and he's literally dressed the way the idols are dressed in India, and he's fighting with a bow and arrow. It had been guns all this time, but he's fighting with a bow and arrow. So this is like harking back to this mythical Hindu past, which is very problematic, I think. Also, like, you know, of course, the freedom fighter he portrays was an ascetic. He used to live in the forest. And so he used to dress like that a little bit towards the end of his life. But it would be very escapist to not know that how Lord Ram's name has become a rallying cry for the Hindu right wing.
Okay.
And I've literally heard from, and I've been looking at tweets and news stories where when he turns up looking like the god, there are chants in the audience. Mm-hmm. And it's not far-fetched. You know, anyone who lives in India today, or even me, like, you know, anyone who doesn't live in India today but is invested in the news, would know how this film can be used to mobilize.
Mm-hmm. Well, even without knowing that, you can recognize the hallmarks of full-throated nationalism when you see it. This is very different, but I grew up under Reagan, steeped in nationalistic, jingoistic pop culture, films like Red Dawn and Top Gun. And, you know, here in the U.S., it hasn't gone away. The Top Gun Maverick made over $1 billion and they got access to all that military equipment because they gave the Pentagon script approval. So we're still dealing with it. But Hindu nationalism is a very specific beast that this film is feeding into. And also there's some caste stuff going on here.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Yes. It is a very upper caste Hindu nationalism that this film is basing itself on. So you see the character that NTR Jr. plays, Bhim, he is a tribal leader. He's historically, he led his tribe to rebel against the Nizam, the local government, and then the British. This tribe is an indigenous tribe of the region, of the southern region, which is now Telangana. He, of course, was a leader, a mastermind, master of warcraft, and all of that. But if you see the film, he is the brawn, right? He's like constantly grunting, pulling the strings off a trap that captures a tiger and all of that. And like, he's like pulling huge boxes of weapons, you know, single-handedly. So he's the brawn of it. And he's described, or his tribe is described, is like, you know, in the pretty much after the child is kidnapped, there's someone who says they're like sheep. They're like picked a herd. They move around in mobs. So there is the infantilizing or appropriation of what it means to be an indigenous war leader, an indigenous people's leader. And at the end of the film, where, you know, there's a quote-unquote happy ending to it, he asks Rama, who's clearly an upper caste Hindu man, that he wants to be educated. He wants the gift of words. Like, you know, that's such a subservient, servile place to put your character and to make him into this, not a sidekick. I mean, I would say they get equal amounts of screen time and equal amounts of bravado and everything. But in the larger scheme of things, he's the enabler. He's helping the quote unquote real hero. And what he wants, like his aim and mission that he sets out with, turns out to be smaller compared to the large nation-building project.
Sure.
So that is what a lot of, especially members of the Gond community, have had a problem with.
Well, I mean, this stuff you're calling out, it is there for a reason, because as I say, everything is here for a reason. There's nothing, it's not sloppy. It's in there because Rajmouli wants it in there, which is why when you start to observe how little nuance there is in this film, you're like, well, I get what it was going for, I get what it was doing, and it certainly caught me up in it. But, I mean, look, this isn't Rajmouli's first film, right? He made a couple of films before this. Bahubali was part one and two. Made even more money, but they didn't cross over. And if you look at it on paper, as you say, freedom fighting, Hindu myths, both Bollywood, Tollywood, and others are churning out more and more epics like this one with stunts and songs and incredibly hot actors like they have here. But when you look at film Twitter's enthusiastic embrace of this film, I can understand, you know, and I've tried to articulate that it is incredibly good filmmaking. It is incredibly well structured. But what do you make of this kind of new fandom? What is it about this film, do you think, that helped it cross over?
I'm a little lost. Like, because, you know, I thought, okay, RRR, the person who made Bahubali, has made this film. I wouldn't have watched it. It's really not my kind of filmmaking. It's a spectacle, like you said, like nationalism, spectacle. These are, at the end of the day, when your higher brain takes over, these are distractions. You know, even to say that, oh, this is a film you can switch off your brain for 3 hours. Well, you shouldn't be switching off your brains for a minute. You know what I mean? So it's very easy. It's very smooth propaganda. And, you know, with propaganda, it doesn't matter if Rajamouli really set out to do it or not, but it's serving a purpose. You know, and I said that, of course, you know, the British colonized us for 200 years, still do in some ways. There are vestiges of that colonial empire in all parts of our lives. But also, it's been 75 years of our independence. you're not questioning what have we done after that, you know? Mm. And there is this thing in India and probably in erstwhile colonies is that you blame the British. Mm-hmm. You're like, you know, we are anti-Black in India because the British told us to be racist. No, like, you know, anti-Blackness has its roots in casteism. In the way we've treated people from the so-called lower castes in our society. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, do you want to watch a film on Boston Tea Party? Sure, you do. You know, it'll be a spectacle. But you also know how modern America is failing its people. And, you know, and we want more art to focus on that. Mm-hmm. So I hope that is not a false equivalence, but kind of a good comparison to make. You know, can I ask you why you loved it?
Because I got swept up, because I just felt like, you know, and again, higher brain functions turned off, and just the fact that he was pushing all my buttons, he was pushing them with such skill and adroitness that I just wanted him to keep pushing those buttons. Again, you think about it later, but not while you're watching it.
Yeah.
We mentioned the male friendship part, and you mentioned homoeroticism. I did not pick up on that because it seemed to me the film was so worried about any possible misinterpretation that it was kind of like it had marked off this territory. It's like, nope, not this is just friendship. Yes, we piggyback each other.
Brotherhood,
yes. But, you know, you piggyback on your friends. Yeah, you know, it's a thing you do. That straight guys do all the time.
Hmm.
So this film crossed over. Does it make you hopeful for the possibility that other films that are maybe smaller and more nuanced might cross over?
I hope so. You know, I think the best part about this whole fandom is that it's opening people up in the West to the reality that Indian cinema is not Bollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But I also hope it's opening up audiences to more nuanced storytelling from those industries, because that is happening a lot. And I swear, like, you know, the grunting masculinity in this film constantly, the first half, they're grunting. They're only grunting.
That's true.
Problems would have solved earlier and quicker if they communicated better. So we are getting to a point in Indian cinema where we have men like that who talk, do emotional labor, and, you know, more of what you want to see in real life. Mm-hmm. So I hope the audiences are also opening up to that kind of storytelling. But what has also been very intriguing and interesting for me is this is the kind of cinema that was made fun of for decades.
Right.
Song and dance, head bobbing. Mm-hmm. So I wish I knew the answer, but I don't. But this is exactly what was made fun of for decades. And now it's suddenly cool again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm intrigued, but also I am excited about that.
Right. Well, thank you for that perspective. And no matter where you fall on this film, we want to know what you think about RRR. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. But Dr. D. Chaudhry, thank you so much for being here. What a great talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. This episode was produced by Mike Katziff and edited by Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. But are you, though? Don't feel bad if you're not. Live your life.
I am.
Well, of course
I definitely
am. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we will see you all tomorrow.